Previously.tv Podcast Network.
Having grown up in the South, where the cops and the Klan were one and the same, my parents didn't turn to the police for protection. They had already felt that the police had turned their own son into the prime suspect in his own murder. So not only is the phone ringing, not only is there a car across the street, but there is the growing sense that the DA is going to actually let this kid get away with murder.
Yancey Ford's Strong Island is a, well, actually it's a flinching look at the injustice of grief and loss, plus two looks at the life and death of Sam Cooke. What a wonderful ep it will be, we hope, as Mark Blankenship joins me once again for The Blotter Presents, episode 24. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. This is episode 24, and I am joined once again by my co-host on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, Mark Wahlberg. Just kidding. It's actually Mark Blankenship.
Hi, hello, and I am delighted to be here.
I am sorry that I made that Funky Bunch reference.
You know what? People have been asking me where my Funky Bunch is since 1991, and round about 1992, I finally just started responding by saying, oh, well, they're dead.
So thematically appropriate for this here podcast, we're going to start out in our most wanted section by talking about Yancey Ford's Strong Island. Let me just give you the case synopsis in case you're not familiar with it. I was not. In 1992, the filmmaker's brother, William Ford Jr., the oldest of three children, was shot and killed in an auto repair shop after a verbal altercation with a mechanic. The shooter was a white man. They'd had a previous altercation. Ford was a 24-year-old teacher who was in the process of becoming a corrections officer. There was a whole bunch of lead up to this involving the kid, Riley, talking shit about Ford's mom. In any case, there were no eyewitnesses to the shooting itself. There was like a brief exchange outside a garage. The two men disappeared into the garage. Shots were heard. A grand jury made up entirely of white jurors refused to indict the shooter. The case file remains sealed. That is from Brandon Harris's review of the film at thenewyorker.com. We will link to that in the show notes. Mark, I take it you hadn't heard about this case.
No, I had not. So I didn't know what was going to happen as I was watching. And whew.
No, I didn't either. And there are a lot of, I will say that not until, or not since Dear Zachary, have I been that sort of braced while I'm watching a documentary by what has evidently become of one of the protagonists. We will get into it later. I will say now, there are spoilers here, so if you don't want the experience of the film sort of settling upon you to be ruined, please come back and listen to this after you've watched it. This movie is heavy, but it's really this beautiful, sad document of a family. Did you like the movie? Did you think it was good?
I thought it was...
It's hard to talk about, quote, enjoying things in this genre sometimes.
You know, it's, I think, incredibly appropriate that you would mention Dear Zachary, which, of course, you and I have talked about many times in our private lives as being one of those balled up in the fetal position, weeping until you can't breathe movies that, weirdly, I was really happy to have watched despite the emotional devastation. And me, this movie was not that. It was not emotionally affecting to me at all. it was intellectually interesting because I got so distracted by the intense, overt structure of the movie that I found that his meaning him, the filmmaker, his heavy-handed stylization of the story actually made me feel an incredible amount of distance. And I wondered if the filmmaker himself was trying to put distance between himself and the story by using all of these very theatricalized tropes. So what I ended up coming away with was an intellectually heavy sense of the enormous injustice that had been happening and continues to happen to this family and to Black people in our country at large, but an emotional sense of almost complete remove. So that was my experience.
Okay. I think that that's, I mean, obviously that's legit. It's your experience. I would not say that this sort of had the like sustained, like continuing impact throughout that Dear Zachary had. This film did win the Grand Jury Prize for Storytelling at Sundance earlier this year. I forgot to mention, you can find it on Netflix. It is out now. I mean, I enjoyed sort of going through, I felt like we were watching the process of Ford's formalism and seeing her sort of struggle with how to bring this to the screen and how to tell her brother's story. And
well, like, I don't know if you saw that it's actually him now. Yancey Ford is trans and now identifies as male.
Yes. I'm sorry. Did I
biff
the pronoun? Sorry. That his formalism and like you're watching this process that he's going through of trying to decide how to tell this story and leave the shooter out of it. And then underline that this was a crime committed against his entire family and not like that. It's not about the crime. It's about the aftermath. But we begin with the rationale for why the family, which was like just chilling in Brooklyn, which the mom loved, why William Ford Sr. decided to move them to Strong Island. And that's clip two.
Which ran on a loop through some of the toughest neighborhoods in the city back then. From his motorman's cabin, he saw a very different New York than my mother. He saw poverty and crime and violence in a rapidly declining city. My father was not a fearful man. He was a realist. He'd already gotten out of the Jim Crow South in one piece, and he didn't want to put his family or our future at risk.
But by moving to a part of Long Island where the city planners had basically made sure to locate people of color in certain pockets, thus segregating them, it did accidentally jeopardize everyone's future. But this was a common rationale for middle-class parents in the late 60s and early 70s to bolt the city. It's exactly why my parents moved to New Jersey. So I found that very relatable. And I also found clip three very relatable, approachable, and just, I think the sort of hero of this film is the filmmaker's mother, Barbara Ford, who just has a way. Let's leave it at that. We'll hear more from her later. But first, here's clip three.
That my mother especially made it really clear that no matter what, my brother, my sister, and I, our principal job in life was to love each other. And I'm grateful for that directive. And it's one of the reasons why I miss my brother so much.
He also talks later about Well, you asked for a clip and we'll get to that. But one thing I found striking is his meditations on how he did not say to his brother that he was queer. He did not articulate that to his brother. It wasn't like fear. It just wasn't something that he got around to doing before his brother's death. And that I think that this is like in his continuing relationship with his brother, it's this sticking point for him, that thing that was unsaid. And between that and the long repeated shots of Ford in extreme close up, and you can see he has a scar on his lower lip, which is like never explained and doesn't need to be. But it's interesting that you spend so much time with this little scar, which is probably from going over handlebars back in the day. I mean, who knows? That scar is like, you know, so much part visually of your experience while he is talking about the emotional scars of this event on the entire family. But those shots could also be seen as too much, pretentious. What did you think of those?
Oh, gosh. Well, let me back up because there are a couple of other things that you've said that I want to make sure I talk about, because this movie, you've clearly indicated by your excellent description of how Ford frames his own face, is, like I said, so stylized. And I feel like it is a breathtaking success in terms of sketching out the family story as a classical tragedy, which I will be talking about a little bit later when we get to my clip. But one of the things that I find so striking is the fact that the movie starts with the story of Ford's mother's father dying because no one would help him at the colored only emergency room. Right. And that notion that they had escaped all of that when they made it to Brooklyn, and the sense of joy that Ford's parents felt when they got to Brooklyn, and that lovely scene where Ford's mother is talking about the Jewish ladies at the, in the apartment building where they lived, all being happy that she was pregnant, and that feeling of finally having arrived in a community. And
right,
the sense of happiness momentarily found and then taken away again because it was decided that a black man's life wasn't worth anything is to me so powerful and horrible to consider. And that's one of the reasons.
And I got the sense, let me just interrupt you quickly to say that I got the sense based on what the friend who was sort of an ear witness to Ford's death, William Ford's death, excuse me. The sense I got was that like, it was possible that if an ambulance had showed up or the police had been a little more proactive in getting William Jr. to a hospital, that he might not have died on the scene.
It definitely came across like he could have been kept alive. Absolutely.
And yeah, or that there was just like some official faffing around while he was expiring on the floor of this garage, like, which did not surprise me one bit, sad to say.
And so, again, all of that said, that's why this movie was such a strange experience for me, because I actually love thinking about the complexity of the storytelling, but the effect of the movie itself, and also Ford's really flat affect as a narrator, I just find it so distancing that I almost want to think about this movie more than I want to watch it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I can see Ford has been a producer on POV, which is the PBS documentary series. And those films can sometimes be a little bit up their own butts with the formalism.
Yeah, like this movie, there are a lot of shots of really long shots where there's just a window and a curtain blowing, or we hold for a really long time on an empty couch. And it's just like, I feel like that the emptiness in this family's lives is so much better explained by the details of the story that I actually don't need the artistic interpretation to help me get there.
And well, and by the family itself.
Yes.
I mean, by Barbara, I don't remember her, sorry, again, his sister's actual name, just that William Jr. called her Cato.
Yeah.
Which is adorable. And like the family does a fine job, but the clip that I'm about to play is during like a very slow, it's a voiceover of a very slow tracking shot of like the center of a split level house and the emptiness of the stairs at night. And coupled with this voiceover, it's like, well, all right, let's listen to the clip and then we can talk about it.
Sleeping and crying. My father was stunned, imploding. My sister was alone.
I mean, I feel ways about the delivery of this, namely that it needed to be sped up, but there is something about sleeping and crying, like in that order.
Mm.
It's like, that's exactly what it is. But that is grief, that you're just sleeping and crying.
Mm.
I thought it was a very, could have been a very stark nutshelling of how a death, particularly of this unjust type where you get no answers and no satisfaction, like forget closure, which doesn't exist, that this chasm has opened up in the family. But I think it like was trying to do the same thing twice at the same time, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree with you. The way I'm hearing you is it was trying to visually and orally communicate the exact same information.
Yeah.
And
each one was like right on the line of too much already. So then
yes.
both together was kind of like, well, this is a lot. But on the other hand, it's so personal that I'm not sure I'm comfortable judging the form.
Well, here's the
function.
Thing. I am super comfortable judging it because the movie is so the movie is so clearly shaped, you know, like. It's not like this is just some home video that got strung together and the emotional outpouring is so raw. Like, I read that Ford took something like 10 years to make this movie. And I understand absolutely that as a personal story, this is incredibly powerful. And I have to say nothing but enormous respect for the people in this family for the grace with which they are able to talk about this living fucking nightmare that America put them through and the people in this town put them through. But at the same time, it is so consciously an art object that I think we are required to analyze it in that way as well. And I feel like you just have to live in sort of a double consciousness because the content of the story and the pacing of information about the family and the delivery of information, I think, is exceptional. And the personal stakes are nothing but worthy of respect and great empathy. But then it's like, also, you went ahead and made an arty film about it. So that's where I'm sort of drawing the line. I actually think the people that we meet in this film, including Yancey Ford, my heart is sort of ripped in half. But then the artist Yancey Ford who put the story into this particular crucible, that's where I'm like, I have some thoughts.
Yeah, well, and I am not sure. I mean, look, this is a true crime podcast, and I think that what he has said in interviews is, I don't want the killer's name in anyone's mouth.
Right.
Because our issues with this are not with him. Really, like he's had enough freedom and we're paying attention to our own grief right now. So that's fine. But on the other hand, enough of the crime gets in that I'm not sure this decision either was the right one or was policed, as it were, to the extent that it could have been For example, from the time Lib 5.
The William was shot and that limo pulled up. The story got made then. That this person was not going to jail, period. You know, this wasn't going to happen.
So maybe I am envisioning the night of the shooting incorrectly, but my understanding is that a fucking limousine pulled up to the garage, this scrawn was escorted into it and basically
named Mark Riley, which we hear like over and over again. Yeah.
Yeah. And I kept whispering Mark Riley in the style of
Mary Riley.
Yes. Thank you. Oh my God. if I have to be mentally ill in that particular way, I'm glad, I'm glad you're locked up with me.
I was right there with you.
Thank you. Mark Riley. Totally lost my train of thought too. Thanks, Malcolm.
So he got pulled up into this limo.
Yeah,
that shows
and then
up.
As of that point, I guess that's easy to say in retrospect, but it was decided by people in power, which the Fords were not and did not have access to, that this guy should not have his life ruined, like the Stanford rapey guy.
Oh, yeah.
His dad being like, well, he'd made a mistake. Like, well, yeah, it was a fucking big one. Have some seats. Ugh. Anyway, either he needs to be in it, like really in it, not at all. Or I think you have to integrate the actual story of how the criminal justice system declined to give shit one about your brother's life and your son's life. Like, I think you have to interface with that better. If you mention it at all, you have to do the follow-up work. I don't know.
Well, what did you think about the scenes where Yancey Ford calls the district attorney and the cop and tries to get them to talk about the case?
I found those very sympathetic and also cringy, just from a having had to report stories standpoint. Mm-hmm. That it's like, this is on film and you're having to, you know, watch and or listen to yourself do these interviews and do this process, and it can be a little nerve-wracking to just know that you're going to get no answer to some of the questions. Mm-hmm. The scene in which he talked to the detective who had the case file, I'm so sorry, he talked to the detective. I don't know what my problem is. I think it's that Yancey sounds like Nancy. I apologize. When the filmmaker speaks to the detective who has the case file and is barely, like, is audibly about to cry and then calls his partner and then breaks down and then they laugh about it, and there's that great relationship moment between the two of them, about that Ford is like, or the partner asks, like, did you start crying on the phone? And Ford's like, no, I managed to rush him off the phone before I started crying. And then they both laugh about that through tears. Mm-hmm. That was interesting. And very relatable to me as a, whatever, not that I'm really a journalist, but as a journalist, as someone who is married, I mean, as someone who has a family, there were moments in this that weren't so artsy, and that was one of them.
Right. And I agree with you, because I think it's really very striking that Yancey Ford chose not to show a picture of the person who killed her brother, of Mark Riley. And I think it's very striking that those moments when he's trying to get answers, that we only see his face. We don't see the faces of any of the people who are saying no.
True.
And I think it really draws a line around the fact that what this movie is about is not so much whodunit, because that's, like you said, closure isn't possible. It's about the various ways that this grief was never allowed to dissipate. And
yes, that's an excellent way of putting it.
And that's why I feel like that you can really look at this movie as being structured like a classical Greek tragedy. And I'd like to tell you how.
I would like to hear how. Shall we hear the clip that you called for, or would you like to?
Actually, that's going to be sort of a coup de grace, okay, if you will,
please,
at the end.
Please take our hands and lead us through some formal discussion.
So the idea of the Greek tragedy is that very often it contains, what we would consider to be a classical Greek tragedy contains a certain number of parts, components, and we can find those now echoed across almost every work of narrative in the entire history of the West. There's almost always some sort of historical inciting incident. There is almost always a moment of recognition, or anagnorisis, as we call it. But that's a moment when the protagonist moves from a place of ignorance to knowledge, which results in either love or hate as the outcome. So, for instance, when Oedipus realizes that he is the one who has poisoned his own family and community, that's when he goes from ignorance to knowledge about his true self. And then also there's the peripeteia, or the reversal, which is when the story changes in such a way that there is no going back. So in Oedipus, the recognition and the reversal are the same. But in, say, for instance, Romeo and Juliet, the reversal comes when Mercutio is murdered in the street. Because at that point, everything changes forever and nothing can go back. Romeo and Juliet could actually be a comedy in the way it is structured until Mercutio is killed. Then nothing can ever return to the way it was. And it has to be a tragedy from there on out. So you look at this interplay of prior history, reversals, and recognition, and you see the way that they all interact to push the story toward an inevitable tragic conclusion. And then the last key element is what's called the scene of suffering, which is when those who remain are left to bemoan what has happened. And very often in the best tragedies, it is their elegant articulation of their suffering that makes us carry their pain with us forever. And there's a Greek play called The Trojan Women, which is almost all the scene of suffering, because it's about women who were kidnapped after the fall of Troy, and you just basically track what's happening to them. And I think that this movie is very much like The Trojan Women, and that this is almost entirely the scene of suffering. We understand that the background history of the grandfather dying when white people wouldn't give a shit about his life. We see the peripeteia, the reversal, when the brother is killed, and then the recognition when the mother, and by extension everyone else, goes from believing that the system will take care of them to understanding that it will never take care of them. And that crushing loss of hope and joy, which is only manifested further by learning that the brother, before he was killed, had actually helped another man who had been shot get the help that he needed.
Who's an ADA?
Who helped a white man who'd been shot, who had been helped a white ADA, and then also learning that while he was in the morgue, the brother got accepted.
And then on the morning that he was killed, excuse me, I'm like in the process of choking to death, but I'm going to make this point, that he was testifying in this trial of this,
yes,
yeah, of this guy that tried to hold up this ADA.
So you just see over and over and over again the faith that this family had that the American justice system and that the American society would honor them, because they were pouring so much of their own love and heart into keeping that system going. And they thought that the American dream was going to take care of them. And then there's that moment when they realize, no, it isn't going to take care of us at all. And all that's left after that is the intensity of their suffering. And that brings me to the clip I've pulled, because we start to see by the back half of the film the various ornate ways that that suffering has evolved, as you can hear in clip six.
My brother's death would drive me mad if I weren't able to hold myself accountable for at least a small part of it. Because then it grounds it somewhere. It puts it on the earth, as opposed to in the ether, or as opposed to in the unknown, or in the anonymous. If I don't ground it in some way in myself, then it's everywhere, all the time. It's ubiquitous. And that actually is a greater, more damaging, heavier burden to live with than to blame myself for not being a smarter 19-year-old when my brother called me and told me about this stupid fight that he had. Does that make sense?
I mean, to me, that's actually the most one of the most piercing moments, because it just points out that this systemic racism and lack of concern for human decency, the way that it poisons people is that now Yancey Ford believes that he is responsible in some way. And in fact, it's easier to carry that around than to just sit with the fact that, in fact, the whole system that your family spent its whole life pouring its belief into, the whole thing is against you. And that, to me, is just the way that we're forced to curdle ourselves and warp ourselves in order to keep going in a life like that. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it made perfect sense to me as a nationally ranked control freak. It's absolutely easier to blame yourself for things that you know intellectually you can't control than to accept, right, A, that you can't control them, and B, that it's because you're a woman, you're a trans person, you're a person of color, a little from column A or column C, whichever the case. Sometimes the world's and just American society's obdurate apathy is like, it's way too much. Like, you can't even, you have to like take several steps back to even see all of it. And it's so depressing that I think it is less depressing to blame yourself, right, to be like, if only I'd, you know, chastised him for getting into it with this kid. But what, you know, why would he have done? It was his older brother, and it probably sounded cool and like he stood up for himself, which is how Ford puts it. So, but yeah, that was a tough clip. And I'd like to, unless you have more on Greek tragedy.
No, just to say that I that's why I said that I like thinking about this story. Well, like, I find the story more devastating to think about than to watch, because it is so much a Greek tragedy. It fills me with pity and fear. And it's a remarkably powerful story that's been shaped, but just something that I prefer thinking about more than I enjoyed watching.
Well, and then the way that you describe this family is really counting naively, although it shouldn't be naive. It should be a solid belief,
yes,
on the system to hold up the memory and the value of their beloved, and that it failed. Ford's mother, Barbara, is talking about being in the grand jury room and how people are reading magazines and doing crosswords and whatnot. And here she is in clip seven.
Serving on a jury, and particularly a grand jury, is one of the greatest privileges of citizenship in this country. And you shouldn't take it that way based on race, creed, or color. You should judge the content of the evidence presented. My feelings were that they just didn't give a damn. And if I die today, tomorrow, or the next day, I will die believing that they didn't care because my son was a young man of color. I will always believe that, always, until the day I die.
Yes, correct, alas. And then, and here's where the spoiler comes in, so again, if you haven't watched yet, step away. Then she did die 5 years ago, which was, I felt... I don't know. I really felt like I had become film watching friends with this woman, and her delightful,
yes,
necklace, and her like chewy bitten off consonants. And then She's in a hospital bed with pictures of the family lined up on the inside of the railing. And then Ford is telling the story about how he thought Barbara was trying to pull herself up out of the bed, but she was actually trying to give Yancey a hug, and that this misunderstanding is still haunting him. And then I looked it up, and she passed away in 2012. And then there's some footage of the roads outside the hospital, but flipped upside down. So yeah, there's really like, that's where the Dear Zachary comparison came in for me. Yeah. Was like, you think you basically have the outlines of the story, but then it sort of like jerks to the left and you're like, oh, here's a lower place where this person that I had gotten used to being in the story and being in the world now is not. I still can't decide whether I agree from a stylistic standpoint with how this was set up, but it was very effective and bracing. And the overall cumulative effect of the film, that is a document of the hole that is left in the floor of your life by grief, that the best you could do is like just decorate around it and try not to fall in, is good. It's a powerful one. It's memorable. I don't need to watch this again, but I thought it was very well done, and I spent a lot of time musing on it after I watched it.
I agree with you. I'm not sorry to know this story. I don't need to watch this movie again, but I have been left with a lot of thoughts, both aesthetic and systemic, about the country, and also, but specifically personal about these people. And yeah, this one stuck with me.
Yep, as it did with me. And once again, I apologize for my many screw ups on the pronoun front. I am trying. I'm very trying. Shall we move along to our cold case double shot?
Yes, let's.
We had initially planned to just do an all cold case episode, two different takes on the life and death of Sam Cooke. But then Netflix informed me that Strong Island was coming out, so Mark graciously agreed to watch that also. But he had already watched both the American Masters episode about Sam Cooke and the Mysteries and Scandals episode. And because I did not want to leave him in the lurch, I also watched them both. And I feel some ways about things. First of all, a very brief case synopsis. Sam Cooke, you all know who Sam Cooke is, I assume. What a Wonderful World This Would Be, Cupid, Draw Back Your Bow, etc. You know him even if you think you don't. Ask your grandparents.
Change is going to come. Cooke,
change is going to come. I had forgotten how much I loved that song, and I thought it was a cover for some reason, and I was sort of pleased for him to.
Well, because it's one of those songs that you think has just always existed, and it's hard to remember that it started somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I must have thought it was a spiritual from the 20s or something. In any event, Sam Cooke's death went a little something like this, probably. Sam Cooke was not a big one for keeping it in his pants and picked up some lady at a hotel bar and went to a different motel. Why? Whatever. He went in the bathroom. She took his pants, possibly to rob him. He was carrying like $5,000 cash. She goes to the motel office. He puts on a sport jacket, but nothing else, presumably because she has his pants, but he didn't have undies on either. Charges up to the motel office. The motel manager, like, he bursts in and she shoots him. And his last words were, "Lady, you shot me." So During an assignation with a woman, not his wife, who probably was trying to hustle him, he got shot by an office manager who may or may not have been working with this lady that he picked up, who was also a sex worker. Not that that means anything one way or the other.
The wrinkles in the case are plentiful. They're like the back of a Sharpay's neck.
I mean, next to the word sordid in the dictionary is this whole tableau. But we're going to deal with the American Masters first, because I think American Masters is a great show that really gives you a sort of broad sweep of the artists that they're talking about. And I learned a lot, actually. I thought I knew a lot of things about Sam Cooke. I did not realize that he was the first person of color to start their own record label.
Yeah, I knew nothing. And also how important he was in bringing a gospel sound into pop music, and the type of impact that he had as an artist. And that is where the American Masters episode really does us right, I would say, as they do so much good work contextualizing him as an artist. And that's why I wanted to pull this clip, because I just thought this clip was a great example of why Sam Cooke matters to the history of music. So let's go with clip 8.
One particular fella wasn't really a Christian, and I don't think he went to church too often. And Sam was singing, and all of a sudden he jumped up and says, "Sing, damn it, Sam, sing!"
Which just tells you, that's when he was still a gospel act, and that tells you about the impact that he was having on the people, because people would come just to hear him sing, and they would just take the name of the Lord in vain.
God damn it, Sam. I also thought it did a great job interviewing other artists about where he was in the constellation and how he formed this vanguard of crossing over. So our next clip is Smokey Robinson talking about Sam Cooke and what they used to call, quote, race music.
When I first started even, a black artist could record a song. It was a huge record in the black neighborhood. It was a soul song, rhythm and blues, R&B. Back before I got started, they called it race music, you know. And then, you ain't nothing but a hound dog, the crying time. Elvis Presley recorded it, same song, and all of a sudden it's pop.
Mm-hmm.
In that same section, there's, first of all, I love how the editing manages to throw shade on fucking segregation, and obviously. But then later, James Brown is talking about some record that Sam Cooke made that was like, they called it R&B, but he's like, it was not R&B. It was pop. They just called it R&B.
Yeah, I think he's actually talking about You Send Me, which was Sam Cooke's big breakthrough song, which is not an R&B record. It is a...
No.
It is basically a Perry Como record who just happens to be sung by a black man.
I was going to say Johnny Mathis, but we will also accept Perry Como. It's like, look, come on. With the strings. But Sam Cooke was not afraid to get a little controversial. I don't know if you tried to track down the actual finished product that's mentioned in clip 10, but let's hear clip 10.
And then we can discuss. You're doing different things now, aren't you?
Yeah, well, now, Dick, I'm working mostly with other young singers, you know.
Wait a minute. Young singers... Cassius Clay is a young singer. Did you do that record?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. This is Sam Cooke. As you can see, like me, he's awful pretty. And we are here now working on a record called The Gang's All Here. And Sam and I, we expect to have this out in another week or so.
Would you like to give us a preview of this disc?
Well, let's give him a sample.
Come on, let's give him a preview.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
All right, we're going to do it.
We'll try now.
Hey, the gang's all here. Join in the fun. Hey, the gang's all here. We're gonna swing as one. Do it again.
I mean, first of all, I'd just like to say that I miss Muhammad
yes.
Ali. I just love that the first thing he says is like, look how handsome we both are. Uh-huh. I'm looking. Right there with you. But just the little run that Cooke fits in at the end there is so great. And then I would also like to underline that I don't know who it was, a disc jockey, record executive, who asks them to hear a little bit of it and then laughs in the middle. That is the whitest guffaw in the world. He's like, ha, 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 ha. I mean, oh my God, he's so white. But I really need to track down this project if it came to fruition, because it sounds kind of
amazing.
Yeah,
now I'm kind of...
I think there's going to be bongos.
I'm kind of kicking myself that I didn't think to look it up, because I want to know too. Is it the like Super Bowl shuffle of its time?
I don't know. Or is it the... Leonard Nimoy spoken word album of its time? I hope not. I will look it up and we'll definitely try to get that in the show notes if it exists. But yeah, then that was Dick Clark, of course, at the beginning of the clip. I always appreciate American Masters because they give you such a good sense of the time surrounding the creation of the art and these artists, but without dragging too much like homework into it.
Right.
So I thought that was a good example.
That's such, so well said. It doesn't feel like homework. And another thing that I thought was so striking is that the circumstances surrounding Sam Cooke's death are basically 0.01% of this entire episode. It's like shoved in at the last minute. In fact, I thought that YouTube was going to cut off that there, because there were so few minutes left. I thought, well, they're not going to shove his whole murder into this. Oh, they are. Roll credits. And I just thought, how telling when you compare it to Mysteries and Scandals that the career gets most of the attention and the death gets just a little bit.
Yeah, but it does get some.
Yes.
And the clip I pulled is noteworthy because we are going to hear from a couple of people in it again. And, well, actually just the one, but Zelda has a couple of assertions that
I'm gonna
need to bring into the light of 2017, because this was made like 15 years ago.
I know you're my heart and my soul for, I know what you're going to say, and I agree with you in advance.
I'm sure you do. Let's hear the clip and then you could say it for me if you want.
What really happened, Sam and this girl, I guess, would be the ones that really know what happened at the motel.
He latched the night latch on and he says, well, we're just going to talk. I didn't have nothing to say except that I wanted to go home, so we didn't have anything to talk about.
They were in the room and he went into the bathroom and she grabbed his pants with all his money in it. He had a lot of money on him. He always carried a couple $1,000s back then, and ran off.
She claimed he was going to rape her. First of all, he didn't have to rape anybody. Second of all, he was in the bathroom. She was on the bed and ran off with his clothes. Now, what did he do? Hey, I'm going to the bathroom. I'm going to come back and rape you. It doesn't work that way.
Okay, Zelda.
Here's another thing that doesn't work that way. He didn't have to rape anyone. You know who didn't have to rape anyone? Bill Cosby, James Brown, just about any other sports or entertainment figure.
Marv
or
Albert.
Any powerful figure who has been accused of rape probably didn't, quote unquote, have to. That's not how rape works.
It's like, guess
Zelda.
What? It's about power. It's not about, I can't get any ladies to go on a date to the sock hop with me.
And I think she probably did take his pants to get the money, but that doesn't mean he didn't rape her or try to.
Both, I feel,
things
like that's
could have
the
been
thing.
True.
It's the first part is exactly what made me furious. And that comes up in Mysteries and Scandals too. Somebody else makes the same argument, like it's an argument. Well, he's the handsome football hero. He doesn't need to rape anybody. One, shut the F up. That's not how it works. But also, too, the second that a woman shows any kind of agency in this situation, she can't possibly have been raped, as though the only way that you can be raped is to be is to basically lie there and be completely helpless and immobile and to just,
and to be a perfect, like, choir girl, Girl Scout the rest of the time. Like, she, like, I don't know if she was a prostitute. It seems like maybe she was. I don't know if she set out fixing to steal his budge, maybe she did. If he, like, it doesn't mean he didn't rape her. Like, it's still a rape. She doesn't deserve it. I don't know what happened, like the guy said. But it's just interesting that this is consistently couched as a tragedy yes. that befell him, when if he had remained true to his marriage vows and, I don't know, shown some sense, like, you've been in the music industry a while.
Yeah, that's the thing. Dude. Like, it is terrible what happened, but you're right that the hagiography around Sam Cooke would be like, he was a handsome genius who didn't need to rape anybody, so clearly he has no culpability in his own gruesome end. And in fact...
Right, in which he died, like, wearing a sport coat and no drawers in the office of the motel.
Like, it doesn't make it any less sad.
Okay. He made some choices. But, like, but yeah, I agree. But
it doesn't make it any less sad if we acknowledge that he had a hand in his own journey. Yeah.
It's sadder, actually. But it's like, that whole dude, what are you doing? Like, you were not a dumb guy.
And I actually feel like if you were to make this film in 2017, you might get more of that, because I feel like maybe as a culture, many of us are just less interested in the narrative of the spotless male hero being brought down by Jezebel.
Yeah. Well, that I think is an excellent transition to Mysteries and Scandals. Had you ever watched this
AJ Benza fronted masterpiece? Sarah, I had never seen it, and I have to tell you, you did bring a very particular gift into my life by sending this to me to watch, because this is hands down the trashiest thing I've possibly ever seen.
Wow.
Like, maybe I'm being a bit hyperbolic. Like, I used to watch Inside Edition, for God's sake, but... Like,
this is up there, though.
In the way, just in as much as American Masters was trying to be classy and about art, the AJ Benza fronted Mysteries and Scandals was definitely just trying to be trashy. It's like the Danny DeVito character from LA Confidential moved forward in time and created this.
Yeah. And here's the first sign. I mean, AJ Benza is really the first sign that you're in some trouble in terms of class in this project. The second is this some like rando talking head who wrote some book called, like, not Hollywood Babylon, but something like that.
Yeah.
And she boils it down to the grossest possible terms in clip 12.
Brilliant talent, a really smart businessman, a really handsome man, and he screwed it all up over sex.
Oh, okay. I mean, and in case you forgot the plank in the Zelda platform of he can't have raped her because he could get it by himself, here she is again with even crazier earrings, repeating the theory in clip 13.
She runs out with his clothes, his pants, what have you, runs to disappear someplace saying he wanted to rape. But what guy says, hey, bitch, you lay down on the bed. I'm going to the bathroom. I'm going to come back and rape you. You know? Stupid.
Okay.
Zelda.
She's really married to this theory. And, like, again, if it went down like that, okay, yes, you're right. It's extremely unlikely that a man is going to announce, I am going to rape you, and then proceed pantsless into the bathroom to prepare himself for the raping. Like, sure. Except, please live in the world for 5 minutes and understand that that's probably not the timeline. Maybe if something had already occurred. I don't know.
I also, like, just
Zelda's
have some
attachment to this theory of it is striking to me.
And her apparent willingness to just roll up onto any old program to talk about this.
Yeah. Like, I'm wondering if we look for another Sam Cooke, like if it was on Biography or like American Justice, if their Zelda would be like in curlers, like, hi again. Just a reminder, no one announces he's going to rape someone and then goes into the bathroom like, God, Zelda, we know. Jesus, she probably has a newsletter. I don't have a whole lot else to say about this. They're very concerned with the idea, because the name of the show is Mysteries and Scandals, that maybe it was a setup, that the woman who actually shot Sam Cooke and the alleged sex worker who was on the bed while he was in the bathroom were colluding, that they were maybe operating on behalf of some like underworld music industry concern that thought that Sam Cooke was getting a little too big for his man of color britches and getting too powerful. I don't think that was necessarily true.
Let me just back up and say this about that theory. Can you pinpoint a moment in the history of recorded music when anyone has felt that an artist was making too much money and therefore had to be rubbed out?
No.
Exactly. Like, at
but
what
I also
point-
can't, it's not like I can't point to a gazillion instances of like titans of pop culture seeming to close ranks against an artist of color.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that they would never conspire to have him hit, is what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, I just don't, especially, yeah, it makes no sense. It's bad for business.
Yeah, Sam Cooke is making everyone who's around him a fortune, so you're not going to kill him. You want to control him in other ways? Sure, go ahead. That's what white people have been doing for years. Gaslighting people of color. That, yeah, great, do that. But don't come at me with this stuff about how they're going to kill him. Like, I just feel like if you're going to have a theory, it needs to make some sort of rational sense. AJ Benza.
Well, all right, here's another theory involving not only the idea that Sam Cooke was actually two Sam Cookes, the friendly, smart businessman who would never rape anyone that we all knew, and the rage ball when it came to money, which is not really followed up with anything resembling evidence, but also a special guest appearance from a certain fictional bookie on 90210. Here's our final clip.
That Sam's date, Lisa Boyer, and Bertha were partners in crime.
The two were in cahoots. I was told that Bertha Franklin was her pimp.
The woman that Sam was with was a hustler. He picked the wrong girl to go with, and they were going to hustle him and rob him.
No one has ever been able to prove that a conspiracy existed between Boyer and Franklin, and no one knows what happened to the $5,000 that Sam had on him that night.
What I think happened, he and that girl went to that motel. I think he was in the bathroom, and he saw her grab that money.
If you buy this scenario, it's possible Cooke may have chased Boyer to the motel manager's office and then figured the manager, Bertha Lee Franklin, was setting him up to be robbed.
And he might have very well taking a swing at that woman.
So, listeners at home, what you also need to know is that while we're hearing all of this, we're also seeing the most shoestring budget reenactments of the events they're describing. Like, you'll
I'm not
see,
even sure the Sam Cooke in this clip was African-American.
I know.
It
you'll basically
bad.
See, like, you'll see, like, a cat's paw reaching for a stack of money, and then it'll say, reenactment. So
I do love that they let you know that it's a reenactment. Like, well, he's dead, so we kind of figured. Oh my god. Also, that guy who's like, he went to the hotel with the wrong woman is Billy Vera.
Oh,
I have
yes.
No of- earthly idea why he's in like one talking head interview. That is it. I don't know why he's considered an expert on things Sam Cooke. Maybe he really was a bookie in his previous life. I don't remember.
He had that one hit song. Maybe Sam Cooke had heard that song. Who knows?
From Heaven?
Yeah, it will. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I just before we go, I do want to clarify, because I feel like I almost talked myself into a corner earlier. I was not suggesting that the white power structure of the record industry would not manipulate an artist like an artist of color like Sam Cooke. Of course they would. I just want to say that the only thing about that to me was fishy and was clearly just Mysteries and Scandals reaching for whatever lurid conclusion it could come to was that the record industry would try to kill him, because clearly that's not how they would operate. They have been systematically destroying artists of color in much more nefarious ways.
Yeah, and it just doesn't, like, I could see if this had been a more professional hit, but like, it's worth noting that Bertha Franklin was like on the phone with someone who heard the whole thing. So either it was an extremely elaborate ruse and this woman was supposed to be an ear witness to all of this going down, and to bolster, it was the owner of the motel actually, to bolster Bertha and Boyer's version that Sam Cooke was belligerent and sexually transgressed against her, or she just happened to be on the phone and wasn't supposed to hear anything because it was just like a couple of ladies who were not tools of the of Capitol Records or whoever.
Possibly.
And certainly his own, I mean, you know, he had his own record company, so I doubt that the others all sort of got together and were like, that guy's got to go. Like, I don't know. It seems like they had enough problems with pay-for-play scandals. Anyway, I thought the American Masters was excellent, if a bit dated in some of its attitudes towards its subject. Mysteries and Scandals, I have now seen one episode, and kind of like when I went on a roller coaster once, I am all set.
I could not agree more. I do think a change is going to come, meaning if I see Mysteries and Scandals on my TV, a change of my channel is going to come.
I think that shit got canceled, but your shit has not been canceled. Mark, where else can listeners
find you? Well, the best place to find me, listeners, is with Sarah at our podcast, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, which we record weekly. We talk about pop music, and we love it, and we have a good time, and we hope that you will come and join us. Coming up in the next few weeks, we've got everything from a discussion of the music of Pink to a shockingly terrible song by Jamie Foxx to a trip down memory lane with the greatest hits of Pat Benatar. So won't you come and join us at Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, available at all of the fine podcast providers that you could hope to imagine.
It's all true. Coming up on the booking sheet for The Blotter Presents, next week we've got my work wife, Tara Ariano, on Law & Order Menendez, and after that, Stephanie Early Green returns to talk about Maura Murray. That's right, the podcast has spawned a limited documentary series. God help us all. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I am your host of The Blotter Presents. You can always find me on Twitter at Blotter Presents or Tomato Nation. You can find us on Facebook at Blotter Presents. And you can email me at Sarah, that's with an H, at previously.tv if you have a if you have any suggestions for the tip line, what we should do in future episodes. Thank you for listening.
Been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.